Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the embarrassing display of Trumpian diplomacy, where the US again was the bull in the china shop, beating up on our NATO allies Canada, Norway and Denmark, who along with Finland, Iceland, Sweden and Russia make up the Arctic Council. At the just-concluded Arctic Council summit in Finland, at which the Secretary of State Pompeo expressed interest in exploiting oil and mineral resources made more accessible due to melting ice caused by global warming. But global warming was a subject the United States delegation was forbidden from mentioning, and it was the elephant in the room that the U.S. tried to scrub from the final communique, resulting in the first time the Arctic Council had failed to produce a declaration since 1996. Joining us is Monica Medina, the founder and publisher of Our Daily Planet and the former Senior Director of Ocean Policy at the National Geographic Society and Undersecretary of Commerce for Oceans and Atmosphere at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, where she led efforts on Arctic conservation. Then we'll speak with Angela Stent, the Director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian and East European Affairs and a Professor of Government and Foreign Affairs at Georgetown University, who served as National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia on the National Intelligence Council and in the Office of Policy Planning at the United States Department of State. She joins us to discuss her new book just out, Putin's World, Russia Against the West and With the Rest, which helps us understand how and why the post-Cold War era has given way to a new, more dangerous world in which Russia is challenging the US and the subject of Russia itself has become a toxic and divisive subject in our politics. Then finally, with the stock market plunging yet again because of President Trump's turbulent trade war with China, which erupted just as it appeared the U.S. had reached a deal with China, we will look into the Trump administration's about-face, claiming the Chinese reneged on the deal and are now threatening to impose an extra $200 billion in tariffs on Chinese products. Victor Xi, Professor of Political Science in the 21st Century China Program at the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California, San Diego, joins us to discuss Trump's numerous misconceptions about trade, particularly how trade deficits are a bad thing, meaning that we are losing and China is winning, and that tariffs hurt China when in fact they hurt American consumers who have to pay the extra tariffs in higher prices for Chinese goods. And although there are legitimate concerns about China's economic espionage and theft of U.S. intellectual property, the markets appear concerned whether a trade deal with China is possible, while a trade war is becoming increasingly likely. However, considering China's sophisticated artificial intelligence-based surveillance, creeping authoritarianism, increases in debt, human rights violations, and its revamped Maoist propaganda campaign and growing entrepreneurial dissatisfaction with state intervention with business, perhaps cracks are beginning to appear in their system. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Monica Medina, the founder and publisher of Our Daily Planet, an environmental email newsletter. She's also a professor in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and the former senior director of ocean policy at the National Geographic Society. And previously she served as a special assistant to the Secretary of Defense, and before that was principal deputy undersecretary of commerce for oceans and atmosphere at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, where she led efforts on Arctic conservation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Monica Medina.
Thanks so much for having me.
So thanks for joining us, Monica. And I must say, this display of Trumpian diplomacy, if that's not an oxymoron, with the Secretary of State Mike Pompeo turning the somewhat peaceful Arctic Council summit in Finland, where the Arctic nations, Canada, Denmark, Finland, Iceland, Norway, Russia, Sweden, and the US had gathered. There was a lot of talk, you know, in terms of sort of militarized talk about big power contests in China, of course, was there as an observer. But the surreal part of it was that the US delegation was forbidden from mentioning the word global warming, and the phrase global warming, the US delegation balked at its inclusion in the final communique to the point where the Arctic Council failed to produce a declaration the first time since 1996. So essentially what Pompeo was arguing was that there's a great economic opportunity because of the ice is melting and therefore oil extraction and mineral extraction is easier. But he refused to even talk about why this was happening. He was happy to talk about, you know, let's go after the resources, but not why these resources were being made accessible by global warming.
It's preposterous and really an embarrassment for the U.S. to have been a leader in this forum, the Arctic Council, working hard to foster environmental and scientific cooperation among the group and to slow efforts to develop in the Arctic in order to understand it better, particularly in the face of all this change. And Pompeo just came in like a skunk in a garden party and really roiled the whole meeting and years of work and cooperation among the Arctic nations and gave China a chance to actually throw it back in our face and say that they're the ones who recognize that climate change is a threat and we're the ones who walked away from the Paris Agreement. So I think it actually even backfired. His own intended purpose was foiled by the ridiculousness of the position that we took.
But Pompeo also went after Canada over the Northwest Passage. That's pretty extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, why is the U.S. contesting the Northwest Passage with Canada over its sovereign rights? Clearly, it's right there above the northern coast of Canada, is it not?
Well, it is. The U.S. has contested that for a long time, and I am not surprised that he took a hardline position on that because he took a hardline position on everything rather than being diplomatic. And it's just a shame for this particular organization, which has always been a source of cooperation and a place where things like the Northwest Passage could at least be discussed in and continued diplomacy and diplomatic efforts to resolve those disputes could happen. So it's just, it's really a big step backwards. I mean, last year there was a momentous agreement, a really unprecedented agreement among all the Arctic nations not to fish commercially in the international waters of the Arctic Ocean and instead to cooperate on science. U.S. led that effort, and Pompeo and the performance of the U.S. at this year's meeting just flies completely in the face of our previous efforts, which had spanned multiple administrations, Democratic and Republican, to cooperate in the Arctic Council as opposed to being combative and using this as sort of a bully pulpit to push our way into sort of Arctic militarization and aggression, where we really are, you know, kind of all wet, if you will. We don't have the kind of infrastructure and the kind of commitment to Arctic, development that these other countries do. We don't have icebreakers. We don't have a port. We really have not acted as if we were an Arctic nation other than in bodies like this one where we were cooperative.
And again, I'm speaking with Monica Medina, who is the founder and publisher of Our Daily Planet, an environmental email newsletter. She's also a professor in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and the former senior director of ocean policy at the National Geographic Society. Previously, she served as special assistant to the Secretary of Defense, and before that was a principal deputy undersecretary of Commerce for Oceans and Atmosphere at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, where she led efforts on Arctic conservation. So it's a bit, again, I don't know whether, you know, it's Trumpian or it is a requisite of being in the Trump administration that you have to act like Trump, which is what Pompeo is doing and being sort of belligerent. It's sort of my way or the highway. But Trump has often beaten up on NATO and never really enunciated the Article 5 part of NATO, which was invoked by the NATO allies when they came to U.S. help in Afghanistan, but he's never really enunciated. That's made NATO members quite nervous, and it's been a gift to Putin. But the idea that we'd have the bull in the china shop in terms of Pompeo at this Arctic conference, where Canada, Denmark, and Norway are all NATO members. And again, we're just being driven by this administration between
we
us
are,
and our allies.
The secretary is probably the most sort of extreme in his views on climate change in the national security team, even in this administration. And that was clear by the way he conducted himself during the meeting. And indeed, it looked like he was sort of playing to the boss, trying to impress President Trump. And it's such a shame because it did both roil this particular body. It did upset the work of years and years of previous administrations to be a leader within the Arctic Council and to use this particular body as a place for cooperation and diplomacy. Even in the most difficult times with Russia and the Ukraine, the Arctic Council continued to be a place where scientific cooperation on safety in the Arctic was, a consistent place for those conversations and that diplomatic outreach to continue. And now this, it's a shame. And I do think it will have repercussions in other forums like NATO.
But when you say, Monica Medina, that Secretary of State Pompeo is pleasing his boss, Trump, by being such a outspoken denier of global warming, and he refused to have the U.S. delegation even talk about it and wanted its mention to be removed from the final communique to the point where there was no final communique, you could also make the argument that he was also pleasing his other boss, which is the Koch brothers. He's a protege of the Koch brothers. They financed his political career.
Yeah, the irony of it is that the U.S. is now unable to do the oil and gas exploration in the Arctic that the Trump administration so touted at the beginning. A federal judge has put the kibosh on that. And in addition, it was becoming infeasible for the one project that the Trump administration had given the go-ahead to for exploration in the Arctic Ocean off the North Slope of Alaska. The project was failing because the permafrost is melting so quickly there, the construction needed couldn't be done because the permafrost, the actual ice bridge that was to connect the land to the drilling site, was melting underneath the drill rigs. And so that had to be suspended, and then the judge put a halt to the whole program. It's ironic, to say the least.
So there was a book written some time back called Global Warring by Claire Pascal, a Canadian analyst, and it made the case that this may well be a huge flashpoint in the future as global warming reduces the ice sheets and the Northwest Passage becomes an issue, which it already is, and it was certainly exacerbated at this Arctic Council meeting by Pompeo, who turned on the Canadians, and they're extremely upset. So do you see this? And Russia is, by the way, militarizing its north, not that it hasn't always, with a big basis in Murmansk, etc. But you were mentioning earlier they have icebreakers and we don't have. So God forbid, is there going to be an arms race in the Arctic?
I certainly hope not. But, the Arctic Council was a place where the kind of cooperation that would keep that from happening was going on. And it's just a shame. And on top of that, the U.S. is not a member of the Law of the Sea Convention, which is yet another forum for peacefully resolving disputes like the Northwest Passage or oil and gas rights in the Arctic or fishing rights or any of the other competing demands on Arctic resources and space. And we have not acceded to that treaty. We are alone among the Arctic nations not having acceded to the treaty. And again, that puts us in a bad spot. spot. It puts us in a bad position in terms of asserting U.S. rights and in terms of resolving disputes and being a part of the resolution of those disputes. And the Arctic is a small, closed-in area. Those countries all have to work together. And as long as the U.S. is not seen as a cooperating government in that body, it will put the U.S. in a bad spot for whatever purpose, whether it's conservation or development.
And how long can the U.S. deny global warming on the world stage like this? It is sort of surreal to have our Secretary of State talking about the great opportunities that the results of global warming are presenting to the exploitation of oil and minerals in the Arctic, but not wanting to even mention why the ice is melting.
Well, it's laughable. It flies in the face of all the facts and the latest scientific evidence of melting in Greenland and lack of sea ice in the Bering Strait, the overwhelming evidence of rapid change in the Arctic is hard for the U.S. to even say these things. I can't imagine some of the diplomats, the career diplomats who work in this forum, how they must have struggled to try to keep their wits about them in a meeting where the Secretary of State was saying such ridiculous and insisting on such ridiculous positions.
So is that his West Point training or something? Is this, I mean, I understand he's compromised in the sense that he's a protege of the Koch brothers. And the other way that he's compromised, at least to my mind, is that he is a believer in the rapture, in this fundamentalist version of the Book of Revelations that means that the faithful people of his religion will be all raptured up and that Israel will begin the countdown for the end of the world. And that is why people support Israel on the religious right, not because they like the Israelis necessarily, but because they need them to precipitate Armageddon. Now, to my mind, that is spiritual pornography. It's insane. But when you have the two of the three top stewards of our national security, Mike Pence and Secretary of State Pompeo, believing in the rapture, isn't that a fundamental conflict of interest? You cannot be a steward of our national security and have an investment in the end of the world.
Boy, I don't know exactly how to comment on that one, Ian. I just can only say that I think the Secretary of State, in thinking that climate change is 100 years off, some distant event that we can ignore for now, seems to be, you know, it flies in the face of all the evidence. And I honestly can't understand how he could possibly take that position. It puts him alone among the national security advisors. None of the others have gone that far in their position, sort of denying climate.
Well, Monica Medina, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Ian, for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Monica Medina, who's the founder and publisher of Our Daily Planet, an environmental email newsletter. She's also an adjunct professor in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and the former senior director of ocean policy at the National Geographic Society. And previously, she served as a special assistant to the Secretary of Defense, and before that was principal deputy undersecretary of Commerce for Oceans and Atmosphere at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, where she led efforts on Arctic conservation. We're going to take a brief station break and back speaking with the country's leading expert on Russia.
Burning Isaac, Jesus coming. Jesus comes to pave the way. Do you believe in his sweet sensation? Do you believe in the second chance? Do you believe in rapture, babe?
This is a cold war.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Angela Stent, the director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Affairs, and a professor of government and foreign affairs at Georgetown University. She's also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and co-chairs the Hewitt Forum on Post-Soviet Affairs. And from 2004 to 2006, she served as National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council. And from 1999 to 2001, she served in the Office of Policy Planning at the United States Department of State. She's the author of The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. And her latest book just out is Putin's World, Russia Against the West and With the Rest. Welcome to Background Briefing, Angela Stent.
Delighted to be on the show.
Well, thank you, Angela. And Russia's Against the West and With the Rest is rather catchy. But what's your sense then of, let's start with the phone call, because there was a call about a week ago, less than a week ago, between President Putin and Donald Trump. And what I find so disturbing about it is that there's no readout of what they talked about, which is the normal procedure. And in all of the private meetings, that face-to-face meetings that Trump has had with Putin, there has been no note takers, as far as we know, and no readout of those meetings. So we simply do not know what goes on in these private conversations. And with the Mueller report hanging over Trump, the dark cloud still has not been removed in spite of Trump's continual call that he's been exonerated, no collusion, etc. So that leads one to feel very uncomfortable about what's going on. And do you feel that there will be ever any clarity? Do you think that William Barr and the Republicans have effectively muddied the water to the point where what's in the Mueller report is not going to be really clarified?
I think it's quite possible that we'll never know the truth. So Richard Nixon was also someone who didn't always have note takers in meetings he had with the Soviet leadership. But I think we've never had a situation where we have a president and we know that there have not been note takers in a number of the most important meetings that he's had, for instance, with Vladimir Putin. So we will probably, I think what we'll know, what we'll be left with is we'll know that the Russians interfered in the 2016 election. That's laid out extremely explicitly and in great detail in the Mueller report. And we do know that there were lots of contacts between different Russians and people sort of around the Trump campaign and in the Trump campaign. And it looks as if there was a lot of freelancing there, too, people on both sides who thought that they were empowered to find things out. But I suppose what we'll never know is the actual role that the president played in some of these developments.
Well, you mentioned Nixon. Of course, his relations with Russia went back to being vice president under Eisenhower, who was, I think, a figure that the Russian people knew from World War II and to some extent revered. And, of course, it was tragic that after Khrushchev's visit here to the United States with Eisenhower, there was going to be a reciprocal visit. Khrushchev had even built a golf course for Eisenhower.
And then they shot down the spy plane.
They shot down the spy plane, and then it all sort of blew up. But Nixon had his famous exchange over the kitchen, if you will, the debate with Khrushchev. So he went back a long way. This is a way to say that the Republicans were always the stewards in many ways of U.S. relations with Russia. And my understanding is that the Russians always sort of trusted the Republicans. They were never entirely sure about the Democrats. And I find it absolutely astounding that now we're in a universe where the Republicans are the ones that are making excuses for Putin along with President Trump. And the Democrats have become the sort of realists on foreign policies vis-a-vis Russia. So what happened to the red baiters and the Soviet haters of old who are now have become apologists?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, what happened was that Donald Trump was elected, and many people were shocked by this, including a lot of Republicans. And because we already knew by the end of 2016 that the Russians had been interfering a bit, and then we knew much more in 2017, for many people, they've now equated Democrats, at least, Trump's victory with the Russians. And Russia has become, you know, a toxic subject domestically in a way that it hasn't been probably since Senator Joseph McCarthy. And so in many ways, in reaction to that, many Republicans have now supported President Trump in saying, you know, we need better relations with Russia. But having said that, we shouldn't forget that the sanctions against Russia, these very draconian sanctions that were passed in 2017 and more sanctions, were passed by a majority of 99-1, I believe, in the Senate. So the Republicans have voted for very tough measures against Russia. But on the other hand, in other ways, you know, they've been supportive of President Trump. So it's a bit more, I think, complicated than just saying that the Democrats are tough on Russia or realists and the Republicans aren't.
Well, you mentioned the 2016 interference and how all of our intelligence agencies came up with a consensus that Russia was interfering. And President Obama met with the top eight legislators and tried to get an agreement to go public to warn Russia. And he was vetoed effectively by Paul Ryan and particularly Mitch McConnell. And I'm astounded at why Obama folded at that point, because what would one expect from Mitch McConnell? I mean, he's the guy that prevented Obama's Supreme Court nominee from even getting a hearing. So I don't know why. I think, would we be in a different situation today had Obama gone public and warned the Russians what they were doing and alerted the American people to this interference in the 2016 elections?
Well, I think it would have depended how the election came out, because I think even if he'd alerted the American people to this, if President Trump still would have won in the way that he won, there'd still be, you know, all of these questions. The interesting thing is, if he'd alerted the public and then Hillary Clinton had won, ironically for the Russians, American policy toward Russia might be less tough than it is now in terms of all of the sanctions and pulling out of arms control agreements. So I think in some ways the Russians might be having buyer's remorse about what they did in 2016, because it has not produced, having President Trump in the White House has not produced a more forward-leaning policy toward Russia, because his hands are completely tied.
And again, I'm speaking with Angela Stent, who's the director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian and East European Affairs, and a professor of government and foreign affairs at Georgetown University. She's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and co-chairs the Hewitt Forum on Post-Soviet Affairs. And from 2004 to 2006, she served as National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council. And from 1999 to 2001, she served in the Office of Policy Planning in the U.S. Department of State and is the author of The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. And her latest book just out is Putin's World, Russia Against the West and With the Rest. So you just mentioned buyer's remorse. My understanding is, even when Putin was contemplating the active measures campaign to interfere with the U.S. elections, I understand that his former chief of staff, Sergei Ivanov, warned against it, thought that there'd be blowback. But Patrushev, his national security advisor, who was quite a hawk, apparently won the day, if you will, and Ivanov was fired. So did something happen there, do you think? Is there a split in this Czechist regime, which is how it's been described, where you've got the Siloviki running the show?
And the Siloviki. I think one has to be very careful about saying with great confidence that they know who said what to whom.
Right.
Because we really, it's very hard to know what goes on. It's a black box in that very small inner circle around Putin. Yes, Ivanov certainly lost his job, although he then had another job. And of course, I think what you have to go back to is 2011, when tens of thousands of Muscovites took to the streets protesting Putin, saying that he was coming back to power. He was switching jobs with then-President Medvedev. And then there were some parliamentary elections that people thought were falsified. And Putin apparently really believed that Hillary Clinton had paid these demonstrators to go into the streets, that the U.S. was interfering in the Russian election system. And apparently it's then that, you know, he became convinced that it was fair game for Russia to do the same thing. And of course, they started scouting out the landscape in the U.S. before we knew who at least the Republican candidate was, and really who the Democratic candidate would be, too. I'm sure there's debate. Oh, there must have been debate about the wisdom of doing this. Clearly, the people who surround Putin don't always agree on everything. But sometimes rumors are put out because people want us to believe certain things, and we don't really know whether that's true. I think what we can say is that people understood that the order had come from on high, that it was okay to interfere in the election. And then that's when you start getting Mr. Prigozhin, who set up his internet research agency, the factory, the troll factory in St. Petersburg, and you get other people, again, many of whom are described in the Mueller report, sort of running around and freelancing with a lot of this. So there may well have been disagreements, but clearly those who believed it was okay to do this won out.
Well, this plane crash that just took place at the Moscow's main airport in many ways seems to bring up issues about the kind of nature of state morality, if you will. During the communist period, particularly during this period of stagnation, there was this pervasive joke that we pretend to work and they pretend to pay us.
Right.
And there was this deep cynicism. And people were essentially stealing from the state to get by. And, the Chechens and others ran black markets in order to supplement a stagnating economy. And in general, there was a kind of moral rot under the communists. And it's just what happened, though, at this airport. It's just absolutely, I find, devastatingly upsetting. And I've always had tremendous affection for the Russian people, but the idea that a plane crashes, it catches on fire, the back of the plane, people are being burned alive, and in the front of the plane, passengers are holding up the one line through the, the one aisle to get out, getting their personal luggage out of the overhead bins. I know it's totally anecdotal, but is there an even different, if not even worse, moral rot under Putin? Because there was a Gallup poll recently that found that 44% of Russians between 15 and 26 wanted to get out of the country. They wanted to go to Germany or the United States.
Well, certainly a lot of the best and the brightest people are leaving Russia. They're going to Europe. They're going to the United States. I would say traditionally, Russians value human life somewhat differently than we're used to in the West. And there have been a number of both natural and man-made disasters, fires, devastating fires in a shopping mall and a lot of other places that show that, this business of, you shouldn't get out of the plane until you take your suitcase with you, even if that delays other people going out. I mean, that's, I think, fairly deeply rooted in the culture. And I think that that's, if you like, an overlay or a legacy really of the communist period. But the sort of attitude towards human life and towards your fellow human beings really hasn't changed that much.
Well, it certainly was on display early in Putin's regime, both with the Kursk submarine and the way that the families of the victims were treated, but particularly in the siege of the theater, where the Chechens, where they pumped in a aerosol form of heroin or something that really they didn't bother. And Putin was in charge of this operation, I understand. They didn't even bother to provide what's called Narcan, which is what revives heroin overdoses here. And there was a lot of collateral damage from the unfortunate Muscovites who happened to be in the theater, along with, of course...
Right, well, the problem there was that the doctors didn't know when they started to take the people out. The doctors didn't actually know, what was in the gas, and they didn't know how to treat the people. I think that's, as you say, that's an example of it. So it's not new under Putin, but it's certainly there.
But what is new under Putin is the extent to which the state's being looted. I know that the assets of the Soviet Union, as it was collapsing, much of it was looted. Some of it ended up in Manhattan real estate. But hasn't there been a systemic looting under Putin?
Oh, certainly there has been. And you have a very small group of people who surround him who've become very rich and a few other oligarchs who've become very rich. And even though the average standard of living of people at least rose in the early Putin years when oil prices went up. Most Russians are now feeling the pinch, and that's why Putin's popularity ratings have gone down. And so, the anti-corruption crusader, Alexei Navalny, he's the most popular opposition figure, not that he's a threat to anyone in power, but that's what people are increasingly focusing on in Russia, is the extent of corruption, both petty corruption and large-scale corruption, and the fact that their own standard of living is not improving.
But it seems ironic that Putin and his cronies are parking their money abroad. because I assume that because this is a one-man show in terms of total control by the new czar, that he doesn't know. I mean, how insecure is he about his own leadership? If he's parking his money abroad, like the Chinese elite are doing the same thing, along with their kids that they're having educated in American colleges, isn't that a statement that you're not entirely invested in your own country and therefore you don't trust your own country's future? So is there a connection there between Putin parking his money abroad and it's supposedly his personal wealth is supposed to be as high as $160 billion, that he himself is not totally convinced of his own tenure or his own future? Will he ever get to spend that money?
Well, I think the fact that he and all of the people surrounding him have parked most of their money abroad is exactly a sign that they don't necessarily have confidence in their own country. Putin is not all powerful. He's the most powerful individual in the system, but he's certainly surrounded by different groups of people who owe a lot to him, but on whose support he also, to some extent, depends. And we know that there are things that maybe he has wanted to get done that haven't got done. So it's interesting that you now hear much more talk about, even though he's now elected until 2024, already the questions are beginning about who's going to succeed him, how is this going to work, is he in fact going to step down then? And so there's clearly already, rumblings about what might happen in the future. We do know that a few years ago, Putin created his own National Guard, just sort of loyal to him, really supposed to be there to make sure that there's no palace coup or popular revolution or anything. So that's a sign of someone who understands their, potential vulnerability and wants to be protected. But ultimately, if all that money is abroad, it's certainly not a vote of confidence in Russia's future.
Well, back to the relationship with Donald Trump, which, of course, is a mystery. You talk about what goes on inside the Kremlin being a black box. we have our own version of the black box. But it looks like Pompeo, who Secretary of State, who was at this somewhat surreal conference about the Arctic in Helsinki, where the United States delegation weren't able to talk about global warming, but our Secretary of State was boasting how much you can now exploit oil and minerals because the ice is melting. Well, we can't say why the ice is melting, right? We can take advantage of the fact that it's happening, but we can't mention why it's happening. So that was surreal. But he skipped an important meeting in Germany and gone to Sochi, and it looks like he's meeting with Lavrov to set up another summit with Trump. Is that what your understanding is?
I don't know. Certainly, as you say, there was a phone call, an hour-long phone call, hour and a half phone call a few days ago, and there are items on the agenda. I mean, there is the question of the future of arms control agreements, which is very serious. United States and Russia have now pulled out of an agreement on intermediate range nuclear forces, but the agreement that expires in 2021 is the one on strategic nuclear weapons, New START, and if the U.S. and Russia don't extend that or do something with it, it will be over then, and that'll be the first time since 1972, since Nixon, in fact, went to the Soviet Union, that we won't have had anything that regulates the nuclear arsenals of the two countries that between them control 95% of the world's nuclear weapons. So that's fairly urgent. And then there's a question of where China would fit in there. And then there are clearly other issues, including Venezuela, where we're sort of on a collision course with the Russians. So there is lots to talk about. And we know that President Trump has wanted another summit with President Putin, and that, that could happen.
Well, Angela Stent, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, Angela Stent, the director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Affairs, and a professor of government and foreign affairs at Georgetown University. She's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and co-chairs the Hewitt Forum on Post-Soviet Affairs. And from 2004 to 2006, she served as National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council. And from 1999 to 2001, she served in the Office of Policy Planning in the U.S. Department of State and is the author of The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. And her latest book just out is Putin's World, Russia Against the West and With the Rest. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into the stock market plunging because of Trump's turbulent trade war with China. with Trump now threatening to impose an extra $200 billion in tariffs on Chinese products. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Victor Shi, a professor of political science in the 21st Century China program at the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California, San Diego. He's published widely on the politics of China's banking policies, fiscal policies, and exchange rates, and was the first analyst to identify the risk of massive local government debt. And his forthcoming book is Economic Shocks and Authoritarian Stability. Welcome to Background Briefing, Victor Shi.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks, Victor. And, of course, Trump tweeted out a threat to China. He's basically accusing them of trying to renegotiate the trade deal that they're hammering out. And he's threatening to ratchet up existing import tariffs of 10% on 200 billion Chinese goods and to raise it up now to 25%. And he's warning that 25% tariffs would be slapped on a further 325 billion of goods in the future, which would mean that essentially everything that China imports would be affected by tariffs. But the amazing thing about Trump is that he doesn't seem to understand the basics of economics. He thinks that by slapping tariffs on Chinese goods, he's punishing China, but he's actually punishing the American consumer because they have to pay the tariffs. So how effective is this going to be, do you think, on the Chinese leadership?
So I agree with you. I mean, to be sure, if the 25% tariff rate were to be imposed on $200 billion worth of Chinese exports, American consumers, a lot of American companies will be hurt. As you know, a lot of American companies now make many of their parts now in China because it is cheaper. And so if these parts have to be brought back to America with an additional 25% tariff, it's going to increase the cost basis of a lot of American companies that rely on Chinese parts. Having said that, what I have seen, at least in the press, is that the U.S. negotiation team had hammered out some agreements on how to enforce tech transfer agreements with the Chinese side, which the Chinese side might have backed away from in the last minute. This might have precipitated the Trump administration to threaten the imposition of additional tariff in this, what I hope to be a final round of negotiations, because certainly the longer the trade conflict persists, the more American consumers and American companies are hurt.
Well, Trump seems to think that this trade deficit with China, he seems to see it in sort of personal terms, in a sense that, you know, they're taking advantage of it. If we have a deficit, therefore they're winning. Again, you get the impression that so much of this is being driven by a basic ignorance of the fundamentals of economics 101.
Yeah, I think most economists will say that the trade deficit itself is, you know, more or less inconsequential and has more to do with the relative savings rates between two countries than to do with, you know, intentional Chinese policies. Although I would say that the Chinese financial system does systematically generate higher savings rates among both consumers and also firms. And unlike a lot of countries which run trade surpluses with the United States, China does not allow private households to invest in the financial market of the United States. So that does create some kind of asymmetry with the financial repression. But of course, although I think this trade conflict that we're seeing now is not completely groundless, I think U.S. policymakers and many U.S. firms have been frustrated for a number of years, you know, of China's lack of enforcement in intellectual property rights, of China's inaction in the face of technology theft by Chinese companies, you know, and many, I just came back from Washington, I think many companies in America, even if they may not agree with Trump's tactic, they do credit the Trump administration for doing something drastic in the face of years and years of technology theft by China.
And again, I'm speaking with Victor Shi, who's a professor of political science in the 21st Century China program in the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California, San Diego. He has published widely on the politics of Chinese banking policies, fiscal policies, and exchange rates, and was the first analyst to identify the risk of massive local government debt. And his forthcoming book is Economic Shocks and Authoritarian Stability. So let's just touch on the Belt and Road Conference that took place recently with a lot of world leaders, among them Vladimir Putin. And I got the impression that there's been a bit of buyer's remorse in terms of some of the countries that have been dealing with Chinese investment. There's been some pushback in terms of debt traps. And Xi Jinping apparently suggested that they were going to sort of take a somewhat different approach. Where does the Belt and Road thing stand now? Is it quite as powerful? And the U.S. doesn't really have... The U.S. puts a lot of money into its military assets, but not much... First of all, we're not putting any money into our own infrastructure here in the United States. They're talking about a $2 trillion deal, which Trump talked to Pelosi and Schumer about, but there's no real plan there. The Chinese are actually doing stuff, aren't they, on a pretty extraordinary scale.
So I think the Belt and Road Initiative now looks like it will be a lot less ambitious than the policymakers in China had thought initially. So, you know, I think initially, you know, there was talk of trillions and trillions of dollars in investment overseas from China. We indeed, the first couple of years of the Belt and Road Initiative, we did see, you know, well over $100 billion in Chinese investment per year. The pace is slowing down out of two reasons. One is that, you know, obviously some of these loans have gone bad, more or less. And China, in some cases, find it strategically beneficial to ask for, you know, ports and so on and so forth as repayment of some of this bad debt. But in other cases, they're simply going to lose the money. So they will lose billions of dollars. And I think that has urged at least the technocrats in China and maybe even political leadership to think more carefully about the pace at which they want to invest overseas and lend money to overseas counterparties. The other constraint that China is seeing is that they're simply running out of foreign currency, at least of that scale, to invest all over the world without, you know, a guarantee of a return. There was a time when the foreign exchange reserve of China was growing at, you know, $50 to $100 billion every month. You know, this was the pre sort of 2012 era. But that time has come to an end. China's overall trade surplus as a share of GDP, as a share of money supply, has shrunken. Labor costs have gone up in China. And more importantly, a lot of people inside of China now would like to get their money out of China to diversify their portfolios. And that creates a lot of outflows pressure. So we've seen $1 trillion leave China's foreign exchange reserve between 2015 and 2016. The Chinese authorities have stabilized the reserve with very draconian capital control measures, which they're still trying to fight every day, the outflows every day. But money continues to leave anyway. So the foreign exchange reserve is simply does not have that much money left in it for very dubious loans to developing countries. Now, China has done something that's, in my opinion, very dangerous, which is they have begun to borrow money internationally in order to finance some of the ventures in developing countries. You know, there's probably a few hundred billion to maybe even as much as $1 trillion in debt that China has accrued in the past 4 years to finance the Belt and Road Initiative, I think, as well as other foreign exchange needs. And I think that's not a road that they can walk down too much further before the financial market react to it.
But the Belt and Road, the one, the northern tier, goes through the stands. And doesn't China have a real problem with the Uyghurs? I mean, I'm just wondering in general whether there's a connection here. The outflow of capital, does it have something to do? You would think that people in China would want to invest in the Chinese economic miracle. But the fact they want to get their money out would indicate to me that they're not totally secure about the country's economic future. And how much does the political repression that's brought about by the reinvigoration of the Chinese Communist Party by Xi Jinping and him being the, you know, Uncle Xi, the new sort of father of the country, and I mean, his first big edict was that we've got to rein in the internet and the press and have much more effective propaganda, and the idea that you're going to have put thousands of Uyghurs in re-education camps, a million, I believe it is, actually, that's not going to work, I don't think. So I'd like to get your take on the politics here. Do you think that repression of domestic desires for more freedom of expression and repression of the Uyghurs, is that a long-term policy that's sustainable?
So I think there are a couple of things here, you know, as it relates to capital outflows. Unfortunately, the mass internment of Uyghurs, which, you know, the estimate is between 1 million and 3 million Uyghurs and other ethnic minorities like Kazakhs being locked up, strangely is popular among the Han majority in China. So I think domestically, this does not cause Xi Jinping too many problems. Internationally, hopefully it causes more problems, but of course we've seen a lot of countries, even a lot of Muslim countries, supporting, at least publicly supporting China's actions in Xinjiang. So that's one issue. That's it's a humanitarian nightmare, and the world should do more, but domestically it has not had too much of a repercussion. What has had a greater repercussion domestically is the increasing tightening of censorship, of propaganda education, both in the schools and even in the workplace. So people who are working in Chinese government units or even state-owned enterprises and even state-owned banks have to now, or even state-owned brokers, right? So stockbrokers have to now use this app to learn more about Xi Jinping's ideology. They're required to do that. So things like that are forcing people to question, you know, whether this worship of a one-man dictatorship really is the right political system for China. Of course, very few people would dare to say that publicly. I mean, a few very brave intellectuals have said that publicly. But most people that I know are complaining about this very bitterly privately. And this caused them to want to diversify their investment to, you know, support the kids' education overseas. You know, UCSD and all the California schools are, you know, filled with students from mainland China, because I think they would like, the parents would like to see their kids to have high quality and ideology free education in the U.S. So I think that tightening of ideological control, instead of just sort of in putting Uyghurs in, I would use the term concentration camps, you know, the ideological control is perhaps a bigger factor in driving Chinese, especially upper middle class, wealthy Chinese, in thinking about alternative destination for their investment or even their citizenship. You know, you have Chinese people, of course, moving out of China to Australia, Singapore, etc., as immigrants.
So just in closing, though, do you think Xi Jinping is operating from a position of strength or weakness? I mean, it sounds like he's bringing back all of that kind of Maoist, you know, rhetoric. Nobody believes that stuff anymore, do they? I mean, how could you believe in Mao's red book when the country is so manifestly capitalist? I mean, isn't there a tremendous contradiction there about bringing back communism, if you will, on orthodox communist orthodoxy in an increasingly capitalist country?
Yeah, it is a contradiction. But, you know, I've talked to some of my students, some of the students in China, some of my students from China, and also students in China. Interestingly, most people do not see the contradiction. I mean, if you sort of walk them through it, they realize it is a contradiction, but it is one that they accept in daily life. It's like, on the one hand, you know, they're asked to believe in sort of Marxism, you know, Leninism, but on the other hand, they know they're under a lot of pressure to make as much money as possible for their families. The system tolerates both tendencies, right? So the system basically asks people to, well, as long as you pledge loyalty to the regime, the Chinese Communist Party, and as long as you do our biddings in a very broad sense, you know, not outright oppose us, then you can try your hands in making as much money as possible, and there will be some opportunities for you to do so in the Chinese economy. And this contradiction, which it drives me crazy also, has worked. Although this, again, I think this increased ideological control, increasingly asking people to spend more and more of their time to study, you know, Xi Jinping's ideology, censoring Japanese manga. You know, my students had a very strong reaction to that. You know, preventing celebrities from gossiping about their private lives. These things are increasingly sort of making people really question whether the system really is incompatible with sort of a modern economy.
Well, Victor Xie, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Victor Xie, who's a professor of political science in the 21st Century China program in the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California, San Diego. He's published widely on the politics of Chinese banking policies, fiscal policies, and exchange rates, and was the first analyst to identify the risk of massive local government debt. And his forthcoming book is Economic Shocks and Authoritarian Stability. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
Lady dressed in white with the man she loved. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.